Blog Talk Radio.
And tonight's first guest is John Strinka.
Hi, Ruth Ann. Thanks for joining the Socialist Party Insight. Today we have John Strinka. He's going to be joining us shortly.
Right here, Stuart.
Here.
Hey, John, you there?
I'm here.
Okay. As I mentioned, I'd like to welcome our listeners to the Socialist Insight. John Strinka, he's joining us today. He's been on the program a few times with us talking about his campaign and talking about what's going on in Indiana. He's with the Socialist Party. Actually, I believe the state chair in Indiana. And is that correct, John?
Local chair.
Oh, the local chair.
Right.
So we're going to discuss what is being done post-election, what is being done, things that John did during the campaign and also what is being done within the state of Indiana since the election. John, what I'd like to do, like we did last time, if you could take just a minute or so and just introduce yourself, John Strinka. Take a minute and just your background and also what you're doing there in the state, and then we'll move from there.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Stuart. I'm John Strinka, and I'm chairman of the Indianapolis Socialist Party. One of the things we're going to be doing this year is thinking about putting together a state party, because we've had some pretty good success, I think, with the local this year. Most notably, this November I ran for the state representative in the Indiana State House of Representatives, and I managed to get 10% of the vote against the incumbent Republican. So I polled 2,862 people voted for me in very red Indiana in Carmel, and I was really kind of pleased about that. So
yeah,
we'll talk about
impressive.
That a little bit more, but we did do that. We had another candidate in the city who polled about 3%. And then I imagine you'll probably talk about it later in the show. But the party itself had a number of candidates across the country, one of whom was actually elected, and so that was, of course, encouraging news. And so today, I guess we'll talk about where we pick it up from here. I thought Election Day was it was encouraging on a lot of fronts. We obviously haven't, we don't have the critical mass we need to succeed. But I think, your own campaign, as I recall, and you can correct me on the numbers because I don't think I have the final counts, but I believe I saw it was something like about 123,000 votes, that you had. And
it was far short of that, but it was a very successful
campaign. I heard you did pretty well in Ohio and Florida.
Right.
So
a lot of the votes, many of the votes, are not even counted in many states, especially when it comes to write-in candidates. You have to, and even some states, you have to check county by county because they don't even report those on a statewide through the national secretary's office, the state secretary's office in some states. So they leave it up to the parties. In California, it's basically the top two. So they only look at the top two that they really concentrate on, even though they report the actual vote count, not the write-in, but they count the other votes for candidates that are actually listed on the ballot. But that would be very generous, John. I appreciate it.
Okay, well, correct me on the numbers, because I do know that a lot of people voted for you in Ohio and a lot of people voted for you in Florida, and that was encouraging. And actually, I'm trying to think. I might have saw the number off maybe part of the thing, or maybe I just misread it or something. But at any rate, though, I do know in Indiana that I have to check the final numbers, because we've got a little detective job ahead of us here, because the initial results showed you receiving 7 votes. And
right.
I'm pretty certain that if I, you know, talk to all the socialists, I'm pretty sure we got more of us than that voted for you. And basically what we then need to do is to document where the votes for you may not have been counted. And
right.
if that is indeed the case, then that may bring up the possibility of legal action, because in the state of Indiana, all certified candidates, all votes for certified write-in candidates, which you were, are supposed to be voted. And if any precinct fails to do that, then they are in violation of the law. So we would be, you know, we would be entitled to redress, and certainly we would have to, you know, kind of look at what happened and see what kind of, you know, legal actions that might open to us.
Well, you have to consider here in the U.S., the whole entire voting system that we have is just completely corrupt. It's been corrupted by the Democrats and the Republicans, and obviously it's been done to their favor. And when even you look here in the state of California, where they have just the top two, and the top two can be even two Democrats or two Republicans, but whoever receive in the primaries the highest number of votes, they are the only ones that even appear on the ballot in certain statewide office. They are the only ones that will appear in the general election. So, as I mentioned, it has been done where it's completely in favor of a two-party system, and to assure that they can. It's a process of elimination for third parties.
Yeah,
John, that's
very clear.
But you did.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, go on. What were you going to say?
No, what I wanted to mention, and this is, you know, I mean, to a lot of our fellow socialists, this is something of a sore point, but I do want to bring up the fact that Jill Stein, who was the Green candidate, and,
mm-hmm.
of course, as you know, the Green candidate, or the Green Party, I should say, is better organized than we are in a number of states. And so she had ballot access in a far greater number of states. But even with that, and even with the things she had done during the campaign, which were indeed, I think, pretty credible, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I want to make clear, the Greens are not socialists, okay? And,
right, they're not.
But,
they're capitalists. Sorry.
Pardon? I'm sorry.
They're capitalists.
What's that? I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
They are capitalists.
Well, but
right.
they are capitalists that are also aware of the really of the abuses in the two-party system, and it's the kind of thing that you know there is some talk that it is in some cases productive to work with them. Because, well, they are not socialists, they are capitalists, there's no mistake about that, they do promote a progressive agenda. And certainly with the kind of crisis that the Republican right is taking the country toward, anything that would be progressive would be, would be something that we have to, I think, give some thought to making common cause with. And in some parts of the country, we do. In other parts of the country, we do not. It's an interesting thing, and I think that's something we have to look at going forward. But the point I wanted to make is that Jill Stein, who was, you know, arrested several times during the campaign, who was arrested, and if you saw the video was really pretty sickening. I mean, when she was arrested in, I believe it was a debate in Kentucky, and she was treated pretty poorly by the police, and it just anybody who saw the footage, you know, I think left a bad feeling for, you know, the state of American democracy. But the point I was going to make is even so, she only got less than half a million votes.
And right, exactly.
Given now, you know, again, obviously I did not get the, you know, number you got, but, I mean, to get only half a million votes with the far greater of number of states shows you really just how powerful and repressive the two-party system is, you know.
Right.
You know, because there was actually, again, another, non-duopoly party on the ballot. And really, I mean, as witnessed by her treatment at the one debate, I mean, she was quite actively suppressed. And I think the less than half million votes is sort of indicative of that, because certainly, you know, her program, will not socialist, certainly had far more elements in common with us than with the two capitalist parties in a lot of regards.
Well, I would say for the most part, the only thing that was even closely resembled to Socialist Party USA is they support single payer.
Other than that, you can go straight on down
their platform, and you could look at it as the same as the Democrats. So I really don't see any difference between the Greens. It's a capitalist party. They support reform. But for the most part, anything that's other than Democrats or Republican, you know, I'm almost ready to say, that we can look at them as allies. Because,
well, exactly.
The other two parties are very repressive.
That's pretty much the point I'm trying to make.
Right.
Because,
and that's a good point.
As you point out, the two-party system really has a stranglehold on our electoral politics.
Exactly.
And it's serving us very, very poorly.
Right, exactly. John, I wanted to ask you also, what made you decide to run? You ran as a candidate in the 39th district against Tor, but what made you decide to run as a candidate in, obviously, in a very conservative, very right leaning community? What was your
right? Going to the background a little bit. But what has happened, and as an aside, what we'll get into as the conversation goes on, this is also since the election been happening in other states. But essentially, in the Indiana House is extremely Republican, extremely conservative, and they had a supermajority in the Senate, but not the House of Representatives. And what had happened is, after a long fight, the Republicans rammed through a right-to-work bill. And they did this despite, you know, thousands of people, you know, in the streets around the Capitol, unions in particular, making their voices heard. And it was, quite clear that this, you know, no one was pushing for this legislation. There was no groundswell of popular support for it. This was simply part of the Republican agenda, and they, you know, pushed it through in a very arrogant fashion. Well, the point being is that one of the primary movers of this was Jerry Tor, who's the incumbent Republican in the 39th in my district. And the last time around, and in fact several times, he has faced no opposition. Unfortunately, in Indiana, it is not unusual, because of the way the districts are gerrymandered and such, where many elections, for important elections, I mean, for the state legislature, for the state House of Representatives, for the state Senate, go uncontested. As an example, Carmel, my 39th district, is one of five districts in Hamilton County, which is the suburban Ring County, immediately to the north of Marion, which is home to Indianapolis. Of the five races in Hamilton County, mine was the only one that was contested. No Democrats even bothered to run against a Republican in the five other House races. And this is in a year after the Republicans just, you know, arrogantly, very egregiously shoved down a bill that was anathema, you know, to anybody on the left, and yet they let it go unchallenged. So to answer your question, basically, I spent a lot of time at the State House, trying to make our voice heard, trying to present a socialist view, and obviously was completely ignored by the legislature. And it just seemed to me that, you know, the people needed to have a choice in an election so that they could show their disapproval. And that's really the main reason I ran, because I felt it was very important that, that the people had some kind of way to show that they did not approve of the Republican legislature's, you know, frankly, radical, you know, ramming through right to work and other legislation. So that was basically the story. And as I said, you know, obviously, I think the issues are pretty clear cut to us. You know, it would have been nice to win, but the fact that 2,862, right. And I really am kind of stuck on that number. But I
have been there in your district, and that number is very incredible.
Well, you have seen what my district
is. Oh, yeah, I've seen. I've been there in your neighborhood, in your district, and that's very incredible that you did that many votes.
But I was very proud of it, and you know, and I worked.
Oh, John, did the that sign have anything to do with that?
Well, I'm sure the
sign was
as
large as a house.
A lot of people told me they saw the sign. I've got, you know, kind of heard other people sort of muttering about it and so forth. So both favorable and unfavorable, the sign did get a substantial amount of attention. How well it converted in the votes, I'm not really sure, but, I mean, pretty much everybody in the district knew that there was a socialist running. So
oh,
I was pleased with that. And again, the point that in a Republican bastion, that 10% of the people would actually pull the lever for a socialist. And I'm very proud of that because, you know, everything about the campaign was labeled socialist. I mean, it was front and center. It was a socialist campaign. I mean, it's just very pleasing to know that that many people consider it viable in the heart of, you know, a conservative stronghold.
And as I mentioned, that's a very impressive number. When you were on the street, how was your message being received? I mean, when you're just talking with people one-on-one and they knew that you were running as a socialist, how were you received by people within your district one-on-one?
Surprisingly well. I mean, one of the nice things about Indiana is you know, the Mideast, I think, has a reputation for a certain you know, generosity of spirit and open-mindedness, despite their voting Republican, and I was heard out pretty well. A couple things come out. Number one, there were a lot of people who see that the country is basically the victim of a rigged system, both political and economic. I mean, I talked to, you know, a lot of people, and they definitely see we're doing things like, you know, cutting Social Security and cutting Medicare and, you know, all these austerity measures are absolutely the wrong thing to do. I mean, the sense of the common good is alive and well in Indiana. And, you know, for the people who believe in the common good, my campaign had a lot of resonance. And a lot of people, you know, talked to me, particularly, you know, at the time of the election. And, you know, we had early voting here in Indiana. And, you know, people would come up to me and say, well, I voted for you, and thank you for giving me a choice, you know, which was very gratifying. But the thing is, despite the reputation, there are a lot of people here in Indiana who believe in the common good, even more than the number that voted for me, because, you know, for a lot of people, I mean, you know, turning your back on capitalism is a major step, okay? But they understand that we need a politics that addresses the common good. So it was responsive. Now, of course, you know, there's always a negative side, you know, particularly as it got closer to election day, you know, some of the opposition, you know, became more virulent, somewhat ruder, and so forth.
Right.
But overall, I mean, the message was received. It was received. And if disagreed with many times, it was still, for the most part, received respectfully. And the point is that even here in the heart of Red America, you know, the socialist ideals have resonance. You know, people can see that it's a fairer, it's a better way to run things. And so
we just have to keep going
until we can get majorities.
How is the organizing for your campaign? What type of support did you get from other people? Did you form a committee, and what type of support was there?
Yeah, well, actually, by state law, you have to form a committee.
Well, I mean, an actual committee where you have, you know, individuals working for you. Was it just yourself and the wife, or
family members, or did you have other people working?
We
did have a committee, and again, due to Indiana state finance laws, it's imperative. But in terms
right.
of the nuts and bolts, yes, we did have people working.
Okay.
Many members of the local party, you know, pitched in. They helped with the canvassing and so forth. Basically, my graphic designs and so forth, because, you know, you need art to put on the billboard,
right.
on the printed ads, that kind of thing. My graphic design was done by volunteers. I had help, you know, in terms of, you know, doing some outreach and again, particularly the canvassing. So we did have a committee. We did have a number of people, you know, pitching and doing different parts of the work. Okay.
How was fundraising?
Fundraising was very difficult. Well, you were at our main fundraiser event, and that's, of course, Jerry Lee Reed performed March in Soho for us.
And it was a very good program.
And it was a fantastic show. And, of course, you know, you and I both participated in the, you know, kind of in the question and answer open session after the performance, and got some, I thought, you know, real good feedback from the audience. And even so, that you know, as well as it turned out, it did not generate, you know, a lot of money. So
right,
so
it didn't pay for
it.
The
was
time.
Worth it definitely worth it was worth doing to raise consciousness, but it didn't do a lot of money. Now the local party was very generous, both to, you know, my campaign and to the other local campaign in Indianapolis, but. Even so, socialist locals don't have a lot of money. That amounted to, you know, several hundred dollars to each campaign. So
mm-hmm.
far short of a war chest.
Right.
So, I mean, looking toward the future, fundraising was a major difficulty, and that's something that we are just going to have to work on and address in the future, because,
and
as you well know, all the socialist campaigns were hampered by, you know, by very tight purse strings. And
right, and myself running as a presidential candidate, the Alexander Mendoza campaign, that was a major difficulty that we had as well, raising funds for to be able to promote our campaign. And it was all the way from the beginning, right after the convention, all the way to the very end. Jared, John, if you had a chance to do all of this over again, would you run for public office again?
That's a good question, and I really don't.
And what would you do different?
Well,
hypothetically.
Well, what I would do different is, and it's funny because, of course, the party had put out a, you know, kind of a question to many of the candidates and so forth, and they asked the question, and my response on that was, well, I'd win. and no, I'm not sure exactly how I would do that, but what I mean to say is that, you know, even with a very limited campaign, you know, I could see that there was a positive response. And I think if we could build a larger structure, critical mass, so that we had more people, you know, working on the campaign, more people doing outreach, I think we could get the idea to people across that socialism is a viable political choice. I mean, the real issue we get is that, or the real problem we run into, it really isn't, just simply isn't on the radar screen for a lot of people. And the only way to overcome that is, frankly, just doing a lot of outreach. And at something over 1,000 party members, you know, we need to grow and we need to get, you know, more committed people to work on these campaigns. So, but to go back to your question, would I do it again? Well, right now I don't want to think about it. I'm just, to be honest, I'm just kind of tired out. I mean,
you feel the same way I do.
Yeah. So I am not thinking about it now. But in the future, particularly, you know, if we have the situation in Indiana where there are uncontested elections, you know, it may be necessary. You know, I mean, it's not. I'm not really a, you know, a gifted politician, but you know, it is kind of difficult, but if it's necessary, I would certainly be open to it. The main thing we would do different, though, is I think what happened, because the ballot access requirements are so difficult in Indiana, really the whole organization of the campaign was built around doing that. And now that we've got a better idea what it takes to do all those signatures, I think we would do more comprehensive planning earlier, and we would certainly begin to recruit larger numbers of people to the campaign, and also be much more aggressive about fundraising, because when push came to shove, we just did not have enough people or resources to, you know, to do better than what we did.
When did you start working on your campaign? Was it months or was it years?
The campaign really started. I mean, the idea for it germinated in the year before, in 2011, as I told you. You know, the Indiana State House had passed through the right to work and a host of other regressive legislation, and I had spent a lot of time at the State House protesting that, you know, and working with the unions and trying to make our voices heard, and we were summarily ignored, and that was not a good feeling. And really, I got the idea at that point because I knew that, you know, as I said, Jerry Tor was running uncontested, and I just couldn't abide that. I was not willing to let that happen. So when the new year started, you know, then you can start submitting signatures for ballot access. So I started at the beginning of the year, and really the first half of the year was pretty much absorbed in getting those signatures. And actually, in retrospect, it would probably, in terms of building a committee, as it were, building a volunteer base, building fundraisers, you know, cultivating, you know, people on the left who would be willing to contribute, you know, to a socialist campaign. In retrospect, should have started earlier. I mean, it's kind of a year-round perpetual cycle, you know, the way our system is. And if we want to break into the system, I'm not saying it should be that way, but I think we've really got to build an organization that's active and activist all year round, every year. And I think that's really what we need to do.
Well, John, what I would like to do, I'm going to have you to mention about Pat Noble. He was elected, one of the members of the Socialist Party USA was elected. I'm going to have you to make that announcement, and then I'm going to come in with an announcement of our guest for next week. But what I'd like for you to do is just announce that achievement there, and then I want you to also take another minute or so just to reintroduce yourself. Today we have John Strinka. From Indiana. He's our guest today. He's been with our program several times before. But, John, could you just take a minute and a half to do that for us? Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Again, I'm a resident of Indiana. I live in Hamilton County in the 39th District, which is suburban Indianapolis, just north of Indianapolis. It's a rather comfortable suburb, and it is a bastion of kind of red Republican activity. And basically, I challenge the incumbent Republican. There's no Democrat running in general in a lot of contests in Indiana. They're uncontested. And to kind of illustrate the fact, there were five state house districts in Hamilton County, and mine in the 39th district was the only one contested. The others, four districts in the county basically had uncontested Republicans that just played a glide to victory no matter what they did or said. And that wasn't acceptable. So I ran against Jerry Toy, the Republican. I got 10% of the vote. Again, stuck on the number, 2,862 people voted for socialism in Carmel, Indiana, which I was very gratified with. And so now we're just, between you and I having a little, I guess, sort of debriefing and kind of, going over lessons learned and thinking about what we can do from here.
And Pat Noble.
Okay, Pat Noble is great. I was a little confused. I wasn't sure if you were going to talk about him.
I'm going to introduce our guest for next week.
Oh, okay. So, yes, I'd love to talk about Pat. Actually, we had a number of candidates across the country for various offices, and Pat Noble is the only one who won. Now, I consider Pat a personal friend. I've met him at a number of party gatherings. I believe you have as well.
Yes,
and,
I have.
He's an impressive guy. He's a very young guy. He's only 19 at this point, or as of the election.
19.
And he ran a splendid campaign for school board. It's the Red Hook School Board, New Jersey, which is in Montclair, New Jersey. And he received, if I remember, it was over 1,000 votes. I believe the exact number was 1,054 votes, which was 54% of the total. So a clear winner in his election. And he will be serving on the school board in Red Hook, New Jersey. And it was, a tremendous
very
victory.
Successful.
And Pat is a... he's a very thoughtful and articulate socialist, and I think he will, he will represent both the people of Red Hook, New Jersey, and the socialist ideals very well on the school board. So we're all looking forward to seeing the contributions he can make. We are extremely proud of that, and I personally, want to extend warmest congratulations, because he did a fantastic job.
And what I'd like to mention, our guest for next week, we'll be having Stephanie Kolinsky. She is the national co-chair for the Socialist Party USA. She will be with our program, The Socialist Insight, next week. She'll be discussing things in regards to membership, party building, outreach, and other things that she is doing actively to help build the Socialist Party USA and to spread our work throughout the country. So anyway, we'll be looking forward to that. We hope we have many of our listeners today to join in again next week. John, we're going to get into a little bit in regards to what you're doing and what the party is doing, the local there in Indiana, in regards to organizing. How many locals are there? How many locals with the SP, the Socialist Party USA, are there in Indiana?
Well, in Indiana, we have only the one local. We have the Greater Indianapolis Socialist Party. That is what we formally call ourselves. And we only have the one party. Now, when talking to some of the other state parties and so forth, there are a number of ways we can go forward in the state. I mean, we can do up a state charter using the Indianapolis Party as a nucleus and just bringing in individual members from around the state, or we can go the route where we can actually try to build some locals in other communities. Now, specifically, there is a good bit of interest in socialism in the towns of our two major universities. In Lafayette, Indiana, there is a socialist present centered around Purdue University. And in Bloomington, Indiana, there is some socialist presence centered again around Indiana University, so the two major state universities. And those would be, I think, fertile places to start organizing. There's a sentiment we don't have currently the organization or structure. That will be something in, you know, going into the future that we will need to think very carefully about and to see what we can do about organizing that. At this point, I won't say that that is unobjective. I mean, we don't really have a solid plan for doing that at this point, but it is something that is certainly in our thinking and on the horizon. The other thing we'd like to do, and that we think would be advantageous to build a state party in Indiana, would be to really add more electoral appeal. One of the issues is it's hard to find people and it's hard to find candidates. If we can use the organization from the start of a state party to generate more interest, we may be able to run more candidates. And of course, the more candidates we can run, instead of being, you know, sort of an exception, people will begin to see the socialist alternative as viable. And now, again, because ballot access requirements are so difficult, even if we did succeed in building a larger organization and, you know, putting in an effective structure with that organization, it would still be extremely difficult to get ballot access. We'd still have to do that pretty much on the basis of individual districts. But that's really the first step to be able to do it. So that's something that we're thinking about, and really we need to go really right back to the beginning in step one and think about, you know, how we want to do this and how we want to reach out, and most importantly, how we can make the party attractive, you know,
right,
on just a day-to-day basis, you know, with activities and social relationships and so forth that people will want to join.
When people look at the party right now, the Socialist Party USA, what is the appeal of the party right now? You say to make it attractive. What is the appeal right now?
Well, the appeal of the party right now is, of course, the ideology. I mean, essentially, the socialist vision is basically a democratic society, both politically and economically, that it's run by the citizens. You know, the people in the communities run their own community, they run their own workplaces, they run their own schools. And have an egalitarian vision where everybody's needs are taken care of. And so the concept is the appeal. Now,
And I agree with that 100%. What I'm saying is what people like about many organizations, they like to see that it's, you know, that it's very active. They're bringing in people. It's a lot of excitement. You know, so what would make it appealing to people to say that here's an organization that is well organized and something that I want to become part of? Because I agree with you. The message that we have is very powerful, and it's relevant to the needs of working people. I understand that. But outside of the message, which, you know, you can have a very clear message that you're sharing with people, but what is it going to be that you're going to offer that's going to say, this is what we are and this is what we're doing, that's going to attract people to come and become part of you?
Right. And that, of course, is exactly the question. Because what we're up against competing, or what we're up against competing, is that, of course, in a capitalist system, everybody is busy out, you know, making a living. And
right.
So since that increasingly is a 24/7 proposition, it leaves very little time and energy left over for, you know, socialist organizing. So,
and I can relate to that.
What's that?
I can relate to that.
Absolutely, and we all can, because we've all seen it in our work with the party. So I think first we need to kind of go back to first principles, and we really need to develop good relationships. In other words, instead of just being, you know, kind of an activity that you affiliate with or identify with, there needs to be, you know, an interpersonal appeal. And I mean, we really do need to be, you know, comrades. We need to help each other out. And some part of our membership, you know, has an issue at work or what have you, we need to be there to support them. I think a lot of things that we're doing revolve around the local left and labor movement. We have a couple of organizations, Unite Here in particular in Indianapolis, that we work very close with, also Jobs for Justice. And they promote basically labor interest and so forth. And we do actions. We support strikes. We will demonstrate, against specific state political actions. As a matter of fact, when you were here, we even joined one briefly. That was the demonstration against Pence, the Republican candidate, was organized with Jobs with Justice. So we will be doing things with that. And, of course, the point is to become, you know, large enough and significant enough so that you always have something significant going on. I mean, as it is right now, there quite frankly aren't enough of us to always, you know, be doing something significant. We've got to expand our numbers, and I think the way we do that, again, is by promoting the ideology and building, you know, solid, genuine relationships, you know, and move forward that way. Because if the relationships are genuine, you know, the people will be willing to give more time to work to influence the political system. Because the thing that happens is people really don't understand, how much time and effort it makes, you know, to really change people's thinking. And so that's really what we have to do. Now, I wish I had it all, a plan from, you know, A to B all worked out. And unfortunately, I don't. But I think that's where we need to be going.
What is the membership like there in Indiana with the party?
Well, our party membership is actually... We are, for the most part, older white guys, and this is something we are working on. We have gained some new members recently, both younger and female members, and we are continuing to try and expand along those lines. Again, with Unite Here, who represents hospitality workers, their population skews young, and we have made some very solid allies. And we have younger people now coming to our meetings. We have not had a lot join us to this point, but there is cooperation, and there is, you know, there is interest in working together. So this is something, I mean, I think in the past, it was really kind of hard to be activist. But now, particularly with the work we've done with Jobs with Justice and Unite Here, I think we are getting a lot more attention and energy from younger people. And so we hope to, you know, we hope to expand on that base. And indeed, looking around, you know, national, some of the I think more energetic locals, and kind of Los Angeles and Memphis, you know, come to mind. That's exactly what they're doing, and I think they're on the right track.
John, when how long have you been a member of the Socialist Party USA yourself?
Well, I've formally only been a member for about 5 years now. So
oh, 5 years.
Yeah, I've only been a formal member. I mean, I've my understanding of socialism goes, you know, way back to my university days. Is, you know, when I became familiar, you know, with the writings and the philosophy of socialism, and you know, for a long time, basically spent most of my time worrying about making a living. And now that my you know, my children are frankly educated and so forth, it's sort of time to give back, you know, and get involved politically. So that kind of accounts for my late formal, you know, formal joining of the organization, although
right.
ideologically it's been attracted to me for a long, long time. It's just that...
So you became a member of the organization about the same time I did. I've been a member of the Socialist Party USA since 2007, and very actively involved after I was nominated the vice presidential candidate in 2000. Well, actually, it was in 2007 when I was nominated. At the beginning of that year is when I actually joined the party.
Right,
but one of the things that you had mentioned, John, I see that when I was on the campaign trail and going to many of the colleges and universities and speaking with students at high schools, it's surprisingly how it is very encouraging how well, you know, the socialist message is being received. I mean, we're being received quite well, but it's that leap that many individuals have just being able to. Just calling themselves a socialist. They agree with what we're saying, but not willing to join the ranks as far as membership. Have you seen the same thing yourself?
Pretty much, pretty much. And it is a situation that I think is commonplace. I've certainly seen the same thing happen. And I think it's really a matter of, again, winning hearts and minds, of kind of getting into people's mindsets and making them see that, you know, our way presents a viable solution. I mean, a lot of the issues, I mean, and it goes to education and a lot of other things, but I mean, citizenship is something of a lost art in our society. I mean, it's delegated out. People don't any longer sincerely believe that they can actually influence the system. And to the extent that, you know, we can run, that we can, you know, influence, you know, real events on the ground, I mean, more and more people will begin to, you know, will begin to get the point that they themselves can control their own destinies. I mean, as it is now, you know, the kid goes to school, he's basically, you know, socialized to obey, he's socialized to become a, you know, a sort of a mindless piece of the machine
right.
kind of thing. And, you know, if he asks you questions, well, don't worry about that, you know, that's taken care of. And, of course, that's the opposite of socialism, because in socialism we say, look, at the workers are never going to have anything unless we organize and do it for ourselves. And I mean, and this, I think, is where we're starting to make some progress. I mean, people are beginning to see, and particularly young people, that the people that they've trusted to take care of things for them have sold them down the river, okay? I mean, it's a rigged
right.
game. I mean, the students in particular, you know, these kids are coming out of school 50, 60 grand in debt. I mean, they're getting, you know, the message that the system is not working for them. I mean,
yeah, we'll give you credit, but we won't give you a job, you know. So.
Yeah. And then when you do get a job, well, you know, it better be 24/7 because, you know, you pretty much need your need to sell your soul to pay off the massive student debt. I mean, it's really, I mean, it's 21st century indentured servitude, and it's
it
wrong.
Is.
And the people, you know, who are being victimized by this, namely the students, see that it's wrong. And
exactly.
And it's, you know, we just need to, you know, develop again this thought that, you know, you can have an effect on the system. You can change the way things are run, but it takes a lot of work and a lot of dedication, and most of all, it takes numbers. And this is where we're at, you know, that stage where we need to go from a relatively small group to, you know, literally a mass movement of millions. And
right,
with,
exactly.
With the situation in the country, we have the material conditions because people see it's not working. They just don't understand why. And the more they see it's not working for them, you know, the more they're going to look for answers. And, you know, we have an answer that you know, is pretty accurate. So, you know, it's just going to be this building of a movement, really, I think.
When it comes to membership within the Socialist Party USA, do you... obviously, the membership is taken care of on a national level, and when I was the state chair here in California, I found that many times it was disappointing because a person would join the party or they had an interest in joining, and sometimes it was like weeks and months before I even knew that I had a new member that was here in the state. But my question is to you, is considering that you're organizing there in Indiana, should new memberships be the responsibility of the state and local chapters, in your opinion?
Yeah, in my opinion, they should be. And actually, in talking, you know, with some people from national, I mean, it can be done that way. In some organizations, and I don't want to misspeak, but I think Texas and Michigan kind of come to mind, that the members, you know, tend to apply through the locals or the state and are approved by them, and then the state organization takes care of it with the national. And I do like that model better simply because it's relational. In other words, what I said before, one of the ways to build a movement is to have, I mean, genuine relationships, and you can't do that with, you know, a kind of disembodied presence from New York. I mean, you need to talk to the socialist down the street, okay? And so, yeah, I do like the idea of running that through, you know, through the state and local organizations. And from what I understand, and this is kind of news to me because our local, you know, before I was here, it's certainly always taken care of it strictly through national. You know, that we do have, you know, we do have the ability to do that for ourselves, and that is something I think I'm certainly going to want to be developing more in Indianapolis.
And one of the things that comes to mind in regards to memberships, I think back when I was the vice president of the NAACP, Inglewood South Bay branch in Inglewood, California, and this is going back 30 years. And even though when I would collect the memberships, it was still a national membership, but I was able to collect the membership. And, of course, at the time, I was on a roll just to build up membership for my local chapter and almost tripled the membership because it was something that I had accessibility to the person that was interested in becoming a member, signing them up, and then obviously they became a member not only of the local, of that chapter, but also they became a member of the national. So it's something that I think would be very beneficial. What do you think the SPUSA could do? How could they offer greater assistance to state chapters and locals?
Well, I don't really know. I mean, I actually have a great deal of respect, you know, for our national people. But I think what the problem is, or what the difficulties the national runs into, is the same that we run into on the local level, which is that we lack a critical mass to
right.
provide a proper structure to get everything done. I mean, essentially, you know, all socialists do their political activity as volunteers. I mean, no one knows that better than you because you were, you know, running for president while holding down a full-time job. And I mean, you know, I mean,
right.
again, I marvel at that your discipline to do that because it's very,
yeah,
very
I was
difficult.
Putting in anywhere between 75 to over 90 hours a week. It was very daunting.
Yeah, and very frankly, I mean, I couldn't. I mean, I just couldn't do that.
I wouldn't know? Want to do that again.
Well, it's right, and I think what happens is the people in the National, of course, are faced with the same challenges. And whereas if you have, you know, an important project, you can kind of, you know, you can kind of reach above your capacity and do more than you think you can do. You can't do that always and forever. I mean, there needs to be first a critical mass of people, and then secondly a structure so that we have a you know, an established way of reaching out and communicating between the locals and national organization. As it is, I mean, I think everybody's intentions are very good, but I think that we just need to have more of us and we need to be better structured in order to really, you know, tighten up the bonds between us. And that's pretty much how I see it. And again, it's a challenge because, you know, it's a lot of work.
Well, John, I have around another 30 seconds where we can speak, and we have John Strinker. He's joining us once again. Excellent guest, and we appreciate him joining us today. Just in a capsule, John, do you think we should be looking forward to running, the party should be looking forward to running a national election for 2016?
Oh, absolutely. I absolutely think we do, and I think that we... You know, we really need to plan it now, and we really need to...
I like that word, now.
Well, I mean, you have to. I mean, you know how much work it is. You've done it yourself.
It's a lot of work.
It's just, and the more people we can, get into the program, and the more people that you know, understand that this is something worth working for, the better off we'll be. But, yes, I think that we should, and it's going to be a lot of work. And
John, could you just spell your name so people, if they want to contact you through Facebook or any other other means, even to go on the internet, just spell your name so people can reach you.
Sure. John Strinka, it's Strinka. I have a Facebook page under my name. And then also you can email me at HoosierSocialist@gmail.com. Hoosier's the state nickname. It's HOOSIER, socialist, one word, @gmail.com.
And, John, once again, we appreciate you joining the program today, and I look forward to having you back on in the future. You're always an excellent guest. And, again, we'd like to thank everyone for joining the program. You can go on the Internet and just get more information for the Socialist Insight, and also on Facebook. Just go to Stuart Alexander on Facebook. Or on the Internet, just type in Stuart Alexander. And my Facebook page is Stuart Alexander Cares. That's StuartAlexander Cares, CARES. And we look forward to having you to join us once again. John, thank you. And also,
hey, thank
Ruth
you,
Ann,
Stuart.
Thanks
it was
for,
great talking about
making this
where we go from here.
Okay. We look forward to it. Thanks
thank
again.
You.
And have a good night, everyone.
I'm just trying to use this.
Hello, everyone.
Hello, Benny.
Hi. Okay, we're on the air. So
right.
Go ahead and announce the
compass. Yes.
We go ahead and announce our show, and then we can bring on our guest is walking in the door. So we posted on the discussion that there was an experience that came to me today. We're getting a lot of feedback. I don't know if it's at our end.
I don't hear any. I don't hear any.
Okay.
I'm not hearing any either.
But, maybe your extension phone. Someone picking up the other phone.
Okay, I don't know. Are you 785 also? I've got two 785s here.
Okay, one of them is a 425. That's Mark.
One is a what?
The 785-425. That's probably Mark calling in.
Okay, that's not on here. My 785-302 and 785-533.
Okay, yeah, that's a guy that's just listening. And ask them to mute their phone, if possible, where they can hear what we're saying. You don't get a lot of background.
I'm going to mute his. Okay, and if he wants to talk, he can press 1. All righty.
Okay.
Good.
All right, so... the reference that I mentioned, I posted on my wall, is a passage that tells about a people that began to experience great wealth because of their industry. Well, they began to divide up into classes, and it caused a great division among the people. You know, those who had an opportunity to learn, you know, versus those who spend all their time working, you know, just to put food on the table. And so, as I mentioned in the description, you know, what did these ancient people think about the term equality and what we call class warfare? You know, specifically mentioned in the third book of Nephi. Today, my friend Mark, called around 10:30, and he said that there was some people that called in. The classifieds is on like 9 o'clock every morning. It's on for 20 minutes, and so people call in there to buy, sell, and trade. Well, this guy called in looking for, you know, to borrow a heater because his heat had been out on at his house since Saturday, and our temperatures dropped into below zero last night. And so, I told the guy, because I didn't call him until about noon. I figured, well, probably the other people called him, but it turned out I was the first one to call him. So he called in at 9, about 9:20, and I called in 3 hours later, and he hadn't gotten a single phone call.
Where is he located again?
What's that?
Where is he located? Where is he?
Well, we're here in Kansas, and this guy was in the next county, about 20 minutes away. And so, our temperature got down below zero. And, when I finally got to talk to the guy on the phone, I said he said he'd never done this before. He'd never really gone out of his way to ask for help. And I said, well, sometimes that's what you have to do, But
sure.
I told him that I thought it took great courage for him to go out and ask for help. when he, you know, his heater wasn't working, and he tried to fix it, and he didn't have the proper tools. Well, the end result of that was that Mark and I went out and took him some groceries. You know, and they just needed some basic, type of, groceries or what have you. But what I wanted to discuss amongst ourselves is, because this is something I've struggled with my adult life ever since I went to Venezuela as a missionary. I would rather take them a month's supply of food if they, if they're out of food and they're not going to get paid until the end of the month. Well, it turns out that that the bank had held up their disability checks. And as far as I've been able to determine from their story and, from looking at their situation, they were in a car accident. They rolled their Durango, so they're, now their vehicle's broken. He lost his job at a retirement center. And so, they're both on disability, and they both end up getting checks. And, I don't know, why it is that they, got behind on the rent or whatever, but the bank's holding up their checks, maybe possibly they'd written bad checks. I don't know the full situation, and I wasn't there to, to pass judgment. But in terms of, finding out how much help they actually need and how much they're willing to do for themselves, you kind of have to be judicious about it, or you'll soon run out of your money trying to help others. Which is one of the problems of living in a system where we depend on money to get the things that we used to grow at home,
I was just reading an article today about homeless vets in America and how there's government housing and apartments that are available to veterans at a low cost, and they touted that the homeless rate had dropped 7% on the HUD report, but I'm speculative of that because there's so many people like your friend that are in this situation that, you have to wonder when they say that the homeless rate has dropped 7%, do they know? How did they know that they're actually, getting everybody, that they know that there's a 7% drop? There's so many undocumented homeless people out there that, I think doesn't really represent a realistic number.
No, it's not. Because it's just like when they say that unemployment has dropped. It hasn't.
Right.
They've stopped
right.
counting people who have totally given up, people whose unemployment has run out. But the rate itself has not dropped. So I'm saying you're right. That figure is bogus.
Right, just like the unemployment rate is bogus. It's much higher than what it is.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Staggeringly higher. Significantly higher. Double what it is.
A friend of mine started calling, another lady, haven't met her yet, but she's kind of part of our circle. We call our tag team is a technology advisors group. But, we're just volunteers who... we're looking at the situation. We're saying, okay, this guy works on computers, but he can't afford internet. And they used to use their neighbor's Wi-Fi, but then their neighbor got behind. And so I said, well, okay, then, what about the library? So that maybe they hadn't considered that they could go to the library, and get on the computer and use the computer. And I mean, I'm over there every day, you know, at my local library, and I mean, they're quite a ways, you know, they're, you know, like say 20 minutes away from where we're at, you know, driving there. And so they, you know, but there is a library in their town, and so they, and most of the libraries have Wi-Fi. But I was asking them, I say, okay, you know, by process of elimination, you know, did they have any family in the area? Did they have a church group that they belong to? You know, I don't want to barge in there, you know, with play Santa Claus if they got their own Santa Claus, so to speak, you know. But they, you know, they didn't really have any attachments. It turned out that the lady across the street, you know, she's able to take them places in her car. But she went out there today and her tire was flat. So, you know, so the guy went out there and helped her, you know, change her, you know, the tire on her car was, you know, bolted on the bottom of, you know, kind of like as a, you know, SUV. And so some of them you have to, you know, unbolt from the, you know, the bottom of the vehicle, you know, to change the tire. So he's not afraid to work, you know. He just, you know, like temporarily disabled. And they set up a system where if you go out and you look to work, well, you know, you could lose your disability if you don't know, you know, how to report it, you know, if you find work. So, you know, how do you ladies feel about, you know, extended unemployment went from 6 months to 2 years. And I think 2 years is way too long for, you know, extended unemployment benefits. You know, you're essentially getting paid not to work, you know, at the rate that you were working. It's not full wages, but it's like, I think, half of what you would make if you were working, you know, full time.
Well, I'll chime in. I feel two ways about it. One, that's our unemployment. You know, that's something that we've been paying in for, you know, our entire lives. So that money should be accessible to us. I think what the problem is the limited amount of work that there is out there. And I believe that, you know, that maybe, you know, maybe I'm totally off, but I think that people that receive unemployment, one, they've already paid into it, so they deserve to get, you know, what is there. I don't think that it necessarily is encouraging people to be unemployed. I think that lack of jobs out there is, you know, that's a real thing. But I also think that, you know, possibly that people that are unemployed that are able to work should be assigned jobs. So if they're getting unemployment or, let's say, extended unemployment and able to work, that there's a wealth, you know, of need out there in the community. So if you're getting unemployment and you're physically able to work, there's schools that need tutors. There's roads that need to be cleaned up. There's the elderly that need to be cared for. So exactly. I think that, you know, to give them an experience, okay, you know, then put them back into, you know, into college or give them something, if they, like I said, if they're able to help the elderly or to help, you know, the children in schools that are really struggling or in soup kitchens or wherever there's a need and there's plenty of them. If you qualify for extended unemployment, then I think that there should be a program that actually puts people to work for that money.
I agree. I think that's wonderful. Yeah.
You do? You don't think I'm crazy?
No, you're not.
I agree with you as well.
No.
But
I think people like that too. Some people really want to be working, and they feel that, you know, they would be doing some good.
Yeah, I would like to show up, like a food warehouse, where, sorting, they had a Goodwill there in Bakersfield. That Goodwill closed down, last year. It was thriving. It had vocational training. It was a really, great, program, right downtown, by the bus station. And, without warning, it closed down. When I was down there in June, I found out that, it was no longer there. And, as we're corporate decisions, by a company that says, well, we can't have all these stores open. Let's move it out to the suburbs. Let's get it out of the downtown area. And so, I mean, that's their decision. But, I was working, in 2010, I was, going back and forth talking to the guy at Goodwill about extending the type of training that they offered. And when I first came out here to Hayes, I saw the Goodwill store, and I said, I called Wichita, I called the corporate numbers they gave me, and I said, if you come out here to Northwest Kansas, we'll have a meeting to talk about vocational, training for people that are out of work. To get retrained.
Yeah, I think a training program would be excellent, and I also believe just psychologically and emotionally, people that are on extended benefits, if you give them something to do, it builds self-esteem, it builds knowledge base. And I think knowledge base is a really good place to start, and put them maybe in fields that are going to be necessary and cutting edge would be sustainability. Start educating people about sustainability because that there's no other way around it. We have to move into the direction of clean energy. And educating people about clean energy and training them to put them to work in those fields, because those fields will be coming more and more available because there's no other way around it. We have to, consider our environment as the utmost importance. And I've talked to a lot of young people, students of mine that feel like, that have said, it's too late. We can't turn back now. Well, with that kind of attitude, and it's not just with my students, it's also with college students, if our future has the belief that it's too late to do anything, then it is. And so we need to start creating.
One of the things that we were doing a few years back, Lisa, when we started contacting people in different cities across the country, is we said, okay, ask the kids, where does the water come from? The water that they flush in the toilets, it came from somewhere. You track the pipes. You tell us where you guys get your water and your power. And see, everybody knows that San Diego, provides gas and electric. But see, if the water company, when the kids look at, okay, the water comes from, ABC company or XYZ company, well, where do they get the water from? Is it recycled? Does it come from the mountains? In other words, just trace the water. It might take you a while to find that information, but we were essentially targeting the parents and the coaches and the real estate agents, that they're concerned about the kids, you know, who live in government housing.
Yeah.
Well, ask them, you know, as it were, where does the water come from? Trace it back. Do your homework. Do your research. You know, find out how it's pumped. Is it gravity fed? You know, flow? Is it, you know, uphill to downhill? Is it pumped out of the ground? You know, who's doing the pumping? What kind of pumps are they using? See, these are things that the power companies forgot how to produce water. The water companies forgot how to produce power back in the 30s. And it was delivered on the part of the government because they wanted to provide free electricity. You know, so they could put a meter on it.
Mm-hmm.
But they wanted to meter, you know, water, power, gas, it's all been separated. You know, so
well, there's over a million homeless students in America. Over a million. And that's just recorded, like I said, you know, in regards to the homeless or unemployment. The numbers are staggering as they're reporting them, but it's not nearly all of everybody. You know, they just can't possibly get to everybody. But with a million students in America being homeless, it's horrifying. You know, they're living on couches.
Let's look at what happens if those kids get excited about, you know, making a difference. We used to use the acronym MAD or Mad Enough to Make a Difference when we were doing radio shows out of Canada. And I believe in that concept. I believe that if those kids realize, you know, their power, you know, that million kids could become, you know, very active in, you know, and I went through homeless in California, you know. I mean, I went through it for a period of about 6 months, you know, on both sides of jail. And, you know, and I became convinced because I was helping these kids clean up their grandmother's, you know, house had been taken over by relatives that were strung out on drugs. And I became convinced that if you don't want to be homeless, you know, study real estate. You know, and so this is one of the things that I'm suggesting, that as far as people being out of work, regardless of why they're out of work, there's somebody in their community that can you know, serve as a coach. There's a local business, you know, owner that has done fairly well, you know, is fairly successful. You know, that person can actually become, you know, a bridge for that person that's out of work to help them, you know, reconnect.
Why real estate, or is that just an example? Because the real estate market now is just, you know, pretty horrible. I mean, unless you're a buyer, it's great. But I'm just curious, why real estate?
Well, because my best man is one of these guys who you know, who spent a fortune on, you know, self-help. He started buying and selling real estate with his credit cards because he read somewhere that you could, you know, get all these credit cards. And so he did. He created his own, you know, credit. And then he, you know, bought some real estate and he, you know, fixed it up. And he started out as an apartment manager with him and his wife. And it was a position that I turned down because I went and took a job with the state of California, you know, as a prison guard. And so he became very successful in real estate. And there's a lot of people that made a lot of money, and real estate is down. They all become coaches for young people.
Hmm. I'm sorry, that was me. I apologize.
Okay. I was going to ask Ruthann if you know, anybody else show up. Maybe I give out the phone number.
It was me. It was me. I had my phone underneath my chin. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Have any listeners that want to call in? 718-664-6436. That's 718-664-6436.
And so, I mean, I've had to come up with some practical solutions in my own life. And every time that I, you know, run into a roadblock, an obstacle, it was, you know, kind of going back to the drawing board, finding a simpler way to get the job done. And, you know, and sometimes you didn't have to, you know, go out and do something unexpected. Shake things up. But, you know, those are not the only business that, you know, there's literally hundreds of thousands of agents. In fact, I'm going to give out a website. It's a real estate forum called Active Rain, RAIN. So, you know, think the word active as in radio and getting active on the radio or radioactive. But the website is activerain.com. And our friend Marilla, when I talked to her a couple years ago about what she was doing, she was literally selling a house every week in South Carolina.
Again, you know, looking environmentally of what jobs in the future are going to be available, and they are going to be, you know, jobs that are in cleaner, renewable energy. And I think that it's important, you know, to advocate for those jobs and create programs that teach our youth. You know, so because let's say, you know, over a decades ago, it was computers, and it always will be. You know, that there's always going to be a market for technology. But I really believe that the wave of the future is going to be in resources, you know, land resources and clean energy. So going back to homelessness and students, I think that people that are on, you know, extended benefits, et cetera, if there are programs that are available to educate the new wave of where job markets are going to be out of necessity. And I don't think that we should wait until somebody is on a extended benefits program. I think that we should start from the ground up. I think we should start early education, and all the way up of prioritizing, you know, ways to clean up our environment. And I think that that's something that the youth and people that are struggling would feel good about participating in. You know, something that's important to our environment and our sustainability, you know, as a world society.
Well, you can imagine that if you were to test the water in San Diego Harbor, there's probably a lot of petrochemicals that have been, you know, leaked, as it were, from...
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Well, there's a couple different companies I know that clean up, hydrocarbons. I think three of them off the top of my head. One of them is Pedego's Oil Spill Eaters, and I'm going to give out their website so people can take a look at, what I think is going to become a trillion-dollar industry is going to be cleaning up after the oil industry. But, of course, it's not going to cost $1 trillion because, you know, as the dollar has less value, you know, the value of clean, you know, water and clean energy and you know, growing your own food, you know, we should be able to learn, you know, from these companies, you know, how to grow our own, you know, enzymes and microbes. And right now they're not willing to teach that. They want to sell product. But, see, I don't mind promoting their products until, you know, I mean, they've offered us as, you know, part of our education outreach, they've offered us a percentage to promote them. And then I've got, you know, other companies have offered me a percentage to promote them. And so I'm not...
Now, we're not talking about the chemical disbursements that they used, right? Because that ended up causing more harm than the oil itself, the BP oil disaster. The chemicals that they used, those disbursements, caused much than the oil spill itself.
Right. Yeah, because what the dispersant did is it contained herbicides and antifreeze. And so what the herbicides did is they separate the water from the, you know, from the oil. And so you ended up with what they called tar balls or asphalt that fell, you know, through the seafloor. And then that was dredged up by the storms. And will continue to be dredged up for 100 years. But the part that separated turned into aerosols. And so it turned all of those chemicals, which it says it's 50 times worse, with the chemicals they added, you know, to the Gulf of Mexico.
Well, they had to have known that. So it was just, it was a quick fix to say that they were doing something, but they had to have known that what they were using environmentally was worse than the effects of the oil spill itself.
Right. And see, that was where we laid it on the EPA, was the EPA was allowing them to use, you know, let's dump antifreeze in the Gulf of Mexico. You know, if you and I were to do that, you know, in our neighbor's swimming pool, you know, somebody would be screaming, you know, there'd be a lot of yelling and screaming about, you know, if it happened at a public swimming pool, but yet that's what happened in the Gulf of Mexico. And so the fact that Monsanto actually set up the board of directors for Nalco 6 months before the rig went down makes some of us suspicious that a lot of, you know, powerful people had prior knowledge that there was going to be a disaster before it happened. So you mentioned cleaning it up. I'm going to give, you know, the website for OSEI stands for Oil Spill Eaters International.
And OS what? OS what was that?
OSEI. Mm-hmm. .us. And I want to get Stephen back on the radio because last I heard he was over in the Middle East in 2010. In the middle of all the stuff that's going on in the Gulf, there was delegations from overseas. It's been used in 35 countries. It's they cleaned up 16,000 spill sites over the last 20 years, and nobody has heard of them, you know, unless they went looking. So that's just one of three companies that I can give you off the top of my head. The other is Bioremediation. And they've offered us percentage if we move their product. But see, the real money isn't in the product, it's in the application of the product. If you got a hazmat company there in San Diego that wants to be part of this, I mean, that's what I do, is I find companies that have the equipment to go clean up these fuel spills. Because I'm just going to predict, you know, based on the last few years that we've been tracking this, that there's going to be more spills with greater frequency because the chemicals that were in the oil in the Gulf of Mexico have made their way into the fuel supply.
Yeah.
And we suspect that they're destroying pipelines all over the world.
Yes.
Okay, so they found a way to create an endless supply of natural gas. We suspect that because they tapped into a caldera, and this time it didn't blow up in their face. It blew up the rig. You know, that was collateral damage. And then they got rid of the oil by turning it into microscopic particles. But what they weren't willing to do is destroy the hydrocarbon bond. And that's what these bioremediated, using enzymes and microbes, to clean up the oil. Some of the microbes will actually turn the oil into fish food.
Well, then this goes back to kind of your original statement starting off the show as far as, homelessness and extended benefit relating to, education.
Right.
This is something, that both could really sink their teeth into and promote. If someone is on extended benefits, that they're to put them to work, on educating them and actually putting them into the fields of, understanding, environmental, or educational, homelessness, working with children and with the elderly, understanding fracking, and understanding advocacy. I think that if we put people that are on extended benefits into the workforce, like, okay, here you go. We're going to, if you're going to accept the money from, what you've already invested and putting into as far as extended benefits, then we're going to put you to work in, understanding how, the BP oil spill or how fracking and, gas in its future, like in Southern Africa, wherever. Putting people to work in industries that advocate for, a cleaner environment in order to receive their extended benefits. If they're physically abled, put them to work. Put them in an industry which gives them the education, which gives that labor force, that advocacy group, whichever, some boots on the ground to actually, understand and advocate against, quite frankly, these atrocities like fracking, oil. We don't need it.
Not just advocate, but what happens is if we teach 50 million kids, or 10 million or 50,000 to make an extra, $100 a month, as it were, with one of these companies that is willing to train people to work online.
Right, exactly. And then give them, a first position into that industry after investing into their education. Put them to work. Put them to work, and then give them a job. When their benefits run out.
Well, here's what I'm offering, and if they're willing to work within 6 months, they're paying off their parents' house. Is that anyone that's willing to work for any of these companies that I mentioned? And I've got about a half dozen companies that I have. Essentially taking them apart and found out how they tick, and I can vouch for them, personally, is that if they go to work for this company and I, as it were, become their coach, I expect them to call me every day that they plan to work. They don't have to call me every day. If they're not working, they don't have to call me. But every day they plan to work, they call me up, and then I'll put them on the phone to them in three ways, and they can listen. What I told these companies, because we can pick up a phone directory, you know, anywhere in the country. You know, if they don't have a computer, you know, they, all they need anymore is a phone to be able to call their coach anywhere in the country. They call their coach and they say, okay, what are we going to do now? And they say, well, we're going to pick an industry. And I used to do this when I worked at the Spanish newspaper in Palmdale. I say, okay, we're going to pick an industry, and we're going to go to the Yellow Pages, and we're going to call these companies and find out who they know that's hiring. In other words, let the company off the hook. You're not calling up and saying, are you hiring? You know, they're going to say no. So you call them up and you say, you know, look, I'm a student. I'm going to such and such school. You know, I'm looking to pay for my college. This is what I'm willing to do. Do you know any companies that are hiring? If not, is there anybody that's willing to train students that are willing to volunteer? And so this is what we call the tag team approach, is, you know, technology advisory group, is that they, you know, the kids have the knowledge. They have knowledge, they have skills, they can help these companies up a Facebook page, you know, discussion groups. You ladies, you have any idea how many Facebook groups I've set up?
I know there's many, many that I know of. I couldn't give you an estimate.
Well, that I personally set up, over 50. I haven't counted them to see how many, but they all have, you know, I use them like file drawers. And so they all have a specific purpose related to investigating, you know, in other words, okay, these are the bad actors, you know, so then you go out and it's like a casting for a movie or a play. You know, you cast the good guys and you cast the bad guys. And so, you know, just as a kind of a challenge for, you know, for your students, Lisa, you know, go on Active Rain and contact real estate offices in the San Diego area until you find a coach. You know, semi-retired, you know, somebody that wants to help kids, that are willing to, you know, to work, what have you. Maybe there's a need for, you know, real estate classes for people that speak languages other than English. You know, maybe that hasn't happened yet. You know, imagine they're probably Spanish and English. Well, what about Filipino? What about Arabic?
Not in our school. Our school is pretty small. I mean, I have a good amount of Spanish-speaking students because I live in, you know, Southern California. San Diego County actually has more Indian reservations just in San Diego County than there is in the rest of the state. So we have quite a few, you know, Spanish-speaking students here. But we have some foreign exchange students, not very many. I have a new student that's from South Korea, but I live in a very small community, and so there's not the kind of diversity here that you would see in, you know, the larger San Diego school areas. Yeah, we have 172 students in my school. That's how small it is.
Right, but see, think about the entire San Diego County area. You know, what the assignment, if they decide to accept it, would be to go on activerain.com and find, you know, the real estate offices for San Diego and ask the real estate industry, what do they need? What is it that, you know, what's holding things up? You know, I'm a student from Montessori, you know, school. They come up with their own scripts, as it were. They're just calling up. They're just kind of doing a survey of real estate offices. They're finding out, okay, you know, in your opinion, Mr. Mrs. Real Estate Broker what needs to happen to get the market moving. You know, so everything now is relationships. You know, everything in our day, as we're in 2012 going into 2013, people are going back to mom and pop stores. You know, I'm in a small town as well. You know, our town practically priced itself out of the food market because they put in a swimming pool down, and so they raised the sales tax in the town. So people are driving 40 miles out to shop. I don't, because I don't have, you know, the luxury of transportation. So I do all my shopping at the store, you know, here in town.
Well, it's getting back to basics. I think that the direction that our economy is going is hitting rock bottom, and it needs to. And I think that that's, you know, another avenue that, you know, students and all people, you know, should be aware of, getting back to the cornerstones of basic life skills, because the dollar is dead. You know, we owe more debt than we could ever pay back. That's why China owns most of the mineral rights of the Keystone Pipeline. They've gotten the top bids for infrastructure in the United States. And those jobs, by the way, are not going to be going to Americans. Those jobs are going to be going to the Chinese, because they're the ones that own the majority share. And when the Chinese have won the rights, you know, the top bids to restore our roads, our freeways, our bridges, those are not going to be creating jobs for Americans. Those are jobs for the Chinese. And so I think that the collapse of the dollar, the collapse of our economy, is imminent. I mean, it's already happened. And so, you know, training our kids, educating our kids, our youth, our young, our old, whatever, to getting back to basic life skills and tending to the land and caring for the environment and, you know, learning kind of the old traditions is going to be necessary. Like, for example, with my organic garden, you know, we have an edible schoolyard. We're building an edible schoolyard at the high school where I work at. And a lot of these kids have never even picked up a shovel before.
Right.
And, you know, I really stress to them that, you know, knowing how to have the basic skills, you know, not just knowing how to change the oil or fix the engine in your car, but growing your own food and tending to the earth are going to be essential ways of living again. Because when the dollar completely collapses, which I believe that it already has, the rest of it all is kind of smoke and mirrors, you know, the fiscal cliff, all this hype about the fiscal cliff has already happened. And there's no turning away from that now. So embracing basic life skills and a way of living is going to be essential for everybody. It's necessary. And I think it's a good thing. You know, getting away from the value of the dollar, of the monetary system, we're either going to be forced into it, or we're going to embrace the change and educate people on how to care for one another and care for each other and learn the skills that are necessary to really, you know, take care of what we've got left.
Now, Lisa, does your school do adult classes?
There's ESL classes. There are some mentoring classes. And we're also working right now on developing programs so our parents know how to support their kids, our students, because some of these kids are just way more advanced than where their parents are, let's say,
sure.
for example, in technology. And
right.
so it's really hard. It's been a real struggle for the parents to get on board because, you know, like, for example, building a portfolio. You know, our kids take pictures from the ground up, like with the garden. You know, the heirloom seeds that they use and the kind of the process of growing food and documenting it and building portfolios on things that they learn. I just use gardening as an example. A lot of parents feel very isolated because
sure.
they themselves don't even know kind of the language that we're teaching, and they feel alienated. So we're developing programs where we, you know, invite the parents to participate with the students.
Right.
So it's a learning program for everybody. So we're all on board so they don't feel so isolated. Because when a parent feels like the school and their kids know more than they do, some people kind of, out of embarrassment, kind of fall to the wayside, and it makes it harder for them to support their kids.
Right.
And what we need is a full immersion. We need the parents on board and actively involved in their children's education. And I think the best way to do that is to invite them to participate, you know, and invest in their kids' education, and they learn too.
Right. Now, in fact, that's how I learned. They put in a computer, like a Mac lab, at my son's school. Both the boys were going to regular public school. That I've been advocating computer literacy for about 3 years before I ever turned one on. And I volunteered to, you know, help out in the computer lab when I, you know, when they put it in there. And so, you know, shortly after that, somebody, you know, the local library put in a computer that if there, you know, like I say, if there's a way to bring into our community here what you guys are doing there, now do you, you said Edible Schoolyard, is that?
Yeah, that's right. It's an edible schoolyard.
Okay. Is there, you know, like a fan page or discussion forum or something we could set up for that?
Well, Alice Walker is the one that, you know, in Berkeley, she's the one that, you know, originated it, and I studied with her.
Really?
So the kids grow their own food. They have an appreciation for, you know, what they grow, and then the process of, you know, cooking the food.
Right.
And having an area, a beautiful area around them where they can literally, you know, where there's, you know, edible flowers, you know, edible, you know, basil and thyme and herb. And then how to implement them into the, you know, into their meals. I mean,
now,
the investment, when you teach kids the investment of growing their own food, harvesting their own food, there's such a pride and appreciation in that, and it's healthy. You know, when kids can sit around the school area and literally graze on what they've grown and being around it and the preparation of it, the outcome is astronomical.
Well, see, I don't know.
I can send you some links, sure, and I can send some pictures of the progress of where we're at with ours right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it started. The elementary school has an edible schoolyard. The middle school has an edible schoolyard, and now our incoming students, you know, coming into the ninth grade. You know, you've got to follow and recognize and honor the process that's already been put in place. So it's continuing teaching
of their education. Is this being shared with other, like, I'm guessing yours is a charter or considered a charter school or a private school?
I had a private Montessori school in Colorado. The school that I'm teaching at now is a public school. It's not a charter school. It's a public school, and any public school can do this. And I think that it should just be a part of every public school.
Right.
You know, every public school can have, you know, an edible schoolyard. Many of our seeds have been donated. This is something for the community. We also have a community garden where the kids go and work in the community garden. You know, it's just an extension of, you know, of the school.
Well, if we call it edible school land, then we can use ESL for an acronym.
Sure.
Because I want to bring what we're doing there. I want to bring here to to our area. And,
it's all free. I can get
right.
You signed up so you can get the entire program.
Sure.
For free. Okay. And it's, you know, they encourage it, and there's grants available to get a garden growing, you know, in public schools. So there is funding available, and there here you are again. There's another opportunity for people that are struggling, or on a benefits program, whatever, to volunteer. You know, here you go. You can volunteer. Here's one aspect where you can volunteer, and help and encourage, you know, a school garden.
Okay, how do we get a hold of Ellis Walker?
You can get, we've got almost everything that we have has been donated. If you ask the community, hey, we need soil. Could you donate stepping stones? Could you donate your time? Could you donate seeds?
Right.
I mean, everybody has a little bit of something. And if nothing else, they've got hands that can work in the garden.
I like that, Lisa. I like that a lot. Can you picture that, Ruth Ann?
Oh, yeah, because I know a lot of people who are working in community gardens, so I've read a lot about the school gardening. I think it's a wonderful idea.
I like that edible part.
Edible yards and things, yeah.
What I want to do also, Lisa, is get a hold of some people that work at the prison that teach, like prison industry vocational.
It's already being done. The best example is in, the name is going to escape me. There's a prison in Colorado, in the southwestern part of Colorado, southwestern part of Colorado. I'll get that information to you, Vince, where there's a prison there that they have they have fish, they have gardens, they have flowers. Prison inmates are responsible for all of it. And it gives them so much pride to participate in something, and then it raises funds for the program for the prison. I'll get that information to you. I can't remember the name of it right now, and it's right along the Arkansas River.
There's a guy. I just met a guy that spent about 5 years out there at one of the prisons in Colorado. But have you seen that program? I don't know if we talked about in Chicago where they were teaching offender, former inmates how to raise bees.
I haven't heard of that. That sounds great.
It's called Sweet Beginnings. So you look it up on Facebook, it's Sweet Beginnings.
We've got 1 minute left.
Our God.
Sweet Beginnings, okay. Chicago.
Okay, well, I'll send both of you the links to that prison and the edible yard.
Okay, we'll be back next week, same time, same place. Good night, everyone.
Good night. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Good night.